We've been working with the Muses here at Mind's Eye Radio about what to get you all for the holidays, and we've got it. Another great Mind's Eye Radio show, this one titled Holidays Without the Hype. Tune in to hear a full hour free of false good humor and annoying holiday music. Instead, you'll hear original poetry, drama, and essays. You'll hear how people in Korea and Taiwan celebrate the holidays, and listen to what kids really think about gift giving. Tune in to Holidays Without the Hype from Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach. Everywhere you turn this time of year, you're bombarded with the hype. Biggest sale of the year. Get him the perfect gift. Be joyous. Celebrate. It's the most wonderful time of the year. Well, I have some good news. If you're tired of the constant assault, you've come to the right place. Welcome to Holidays Without the Hype from Mind's Eye Radio, the most creative hour on the air. I'm your host, Greg Willard. In the next hour, several writers will give you their own unique brand of holiday gifts. Original fiction, satire, commentary, and music. We'll look at Christmas through the eyes of a young Jewish girl, follow a down-and-out father on a desperate search for a Christmas tree, and hear kids talk about what they really think about gift-giving. All that and much more. So stay tuned for Holidays Without the Hype.
Hello, I'm Walter Wiggins, Vice President of Holiday Cheer for Omnicorp International. For generations, you've relied on a single, North Pole-based organization for your holiday needs. Is your family ready for a change? If so, then you might want to know about our new Omnicorp is Coming to Town program. We feel this program offers advantages you simply can't find anywhere else. For one thing, we don't have simplistic naughty and nice categories. We use a comprehensive behavioral matrix that identifies your child as endearingly sassy, graciously cryptic, and anything else you can think of. And we don't just check our list twice. With our automated verification program, each child is checked every week. As Christmas approaches, we monitor your child even more closely, so that even in the event of a dramatic behavioral shift, the gifts your child receives are commensurate with his or her Yuletide conduct and demeanor. Why wait hours in line at a department store for an unsanitary lap sitting when your child can submit gift requests to Omnicorp over the phone or the internet? Our use of a standardized 20-item questionnaire ensures consistency and reliability. And you can be assured that Omnicorp toys are made in America. No reliance on foreign polar labor here. When your presents are ready, they won't be delivered by chimney, where they're subject to soot damage. An Omnicorp employee will arrive at your home on Christmas morning. You can pay upfront in milk and cookies if you'd like, but we also accept eggnog, cranberry sauce, plum pudding, and all major candy cane brands. And if money's tight around the holidays, you can take advantage of our monthly fruitcake installment plan. The benefits of working with Omnicorp extend beyond the holidays. Since we give your name and address to dozens of toy companies, you'll be sure to have plenty of ideas for birthdays and other special events. So remember, folks, for a holiday gift program with personal service and efficient delivery, Omnicorp is coming to town.
That was Christian Newhouse, and this is Holidays Without the Hype on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm Greg Willard. Is Christmas really just hype from the toy manufacturers to make sure we put lots of money into their coffers? What do kids really think about giving and getting gifts? Elena Tabachnik spoke with some kids to hear what they have to say.
Is that when they have Christmas at Ogama's house, we can crawl around under the table with the big Christmas trees on and search around for all of our presents. And it's really neat because you're in this like little house and everything, and there's like all full of presents and everything. It's really fun.
Just kind of like natural that you want to give something back. Like, they do something nice for you, or you want to do something nice for them.
Yeah, well, it's like...
Like a thanks?
Yeah, like a thanks.
It's like on Christmas or something, all your parents are all going out and buying everything for everybody, and you're just sitting back and receive them. It's fun.
Is that fun?
As you get older, you feel like, oh, you should be doing something back for them. Because, I mean, if you're a kid, and, I mean, if you're only, like, 5, 8, you can't really do anything about it. The feeling that you did something nice for somebody, that you went out and spent your money on somebody else instead of just yourself.
That's what I was going to say.
What were you going to say?
I know something.
Exactly what Lewis just said.
It shows that somebody cares about you.
Well, no.
Yeah, something like if you really wanted something but they didn't get it for you.
I mean, you've been getting.
Yeah, like your last present and you really wanted something and your mom like promised she would get it for you but she didn't. And then you don't have it, you feel sort of bad. Like, I wish this day never happened.
Oh, yeah, I should still be thankful because you got stuff. It doesn't really matter what you get as long as you get some.
Like, I really wanted some dynamite, and then I saw a person that said, be dangerous, this is dangerous, beware. But then I opened it, and it turned into shark's jaws. It wasn't dynamite.
You thought you got dynamite?
Are you mad?
Very mad.
Oh, yeah, they're going to use dynamite.
Why would they give dynamites to, like, 7-year-olds?
To be nice.
Yeah, you got to be nice.
Actually, it's not really being nice to them because they would blow them up.
Can you remember any time that was kind of bad when you got something in?
My Christmas present, a dog, like a couple weeks later, it got run over.
The dog we got after that ran away, and the dog I got after that got run over, so we're going to take a break from dogs for a while.
So tell me this, what do you really want this year?
A dog?
Another
I need a new pair of rollerblades.
Me too.
What about you, Louis?
I need a CD player or a new pair of rollerblades.
Yeah, CD player.
You need...
PSX 2.
Uh-huh. New pair of rollerblades.
I basically everything I basically wanted.
My mom always got me.
Let's see.
She said cats are better than dogs.
You have everything you always wanted?
Yeah, not everything.
Well, then why are we talking to her?
Like, not dogs, but I got all the main stuff I've always been wanting.
So she doesn't want anything for Christmas.
Uh-huh. But you
no,
still
it's not
want
that.
To get presents.
I want, like, little things, like chocolates or something. Uh-huh. You know what? You know what? You know what I like doing better than getting presents? What? Unwrapping them.
People raised in the Christian tradition like to see Christmas as a time of sharing and peace, a time for us to come together. But in reality, the Christmas season isolates and separates huge numbers of people, as writer Fran Zell discovered.
I remember being 6 years old and pleading with my mother to buy a Christmas tree, knowing she would say no, we couldn't have a tree. We were Jewish. We had Christmas, though. We had turkey and relatives and gaily wrapped presents piled by the fireplace on Christmas morning, because Santa traveled down chimneys after all, and if there wasn't a tree to leave things under, well, he just deposited everything on the hearth and whisked back up the chimney to the next house where there was a tree. I don't remember believing in Santa Claus. Not really. David and I had our pictures taken each year with a department store Santa, both of us smiling with proper wonder and respect. And I can remember, long after I was old enough to know better, staring out my bedroom window late on Christmas Eve, watching the sky for just the faintest sign of flying sleds. But it was all just a game you were supposed to play, like hopscotch, old maid, pickup sticks. I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus was a hit when I was 6, and David and I figured it out. We knew who Mommy should really kiss, even if we rarely saw her do it. We knew who brought the presents. After all the relatives left on Christmas Day, after all the dishes were washed and put away and the carpet sweeper run to pick up Christmas crumbs, my parents bundled David and me into our winter coats and hats with ear flaps and took us to see the Christmas lights in Mapleton Hills. This nearby suburb was newer than ours, wealthier, and besides its great Christmas displays, famous for one other important thing. If you were Jewish or Negro, or even Catholic, you couldn't live there. Home after big home glowed with twinkling lights of every color, floodlit Santas, elves, snowmen. Sometimes we came upon a manger scene, complete with huge ceramic shepherds and sheep, even straw scattered on the snowy lawn. And if my father cranked down his window to flick cigarette ash, we might hear the recorded strains of Away in a Manger, or Little Town of Bethlehem, songs I never dared sing the words to when they taught us in school. "Jack, let's go," my mother would nervously prod when my father lingered too long in front of one of the manger scene houses. "Wait a while," he would reply, if he replied, and continue staring out the window smoking. And I would wonder if my father felt the same horror I did, the same chilling fascination of our having come, undetected as Jews, so close to the forbidden heart of Christmas. This is Fran Zell for Mind's Eye Radio.
This and other short stories by Fran Zell are available from Keylog Press. Here's poet Esther Cameron.
This poem was written during the winter holiday season in 1974. I was raised as a Protestant, but in 1974 I was beginning to move towards conversion to Judaism. Yet I had, and I still have, warm memories of Christmas as a child. This time of year for me is always a time for thinking about the division between the two traditions. In this particular year, Hanukkah Eve is also Christmas Eve, and Christmas falls on the first day of Hanukkah. So I am hoping that will give people thoughts about bridging the gap between the traditions. A Carol Without Song for Winter Turning. Another year will fix a star with one more point atop a small pine, but leave it in the woods. Another year will search our minds for stories, for new truths not yet told, and give them to each other in a corner where 9 or 7 candles burn. Another year will take the boards away from the opening to the highest attic. The dead will descend, something in their hands. We'll trade them smiles jeweled with tears for their dreams of quiet crystal. The unborn, tall, will turn like angels above candle flames. We'll clasp hands with the holly and with the ivy. Between brows a pure mirror will be unveiled, and the doors behind foreheads swing inward. My love is wandering still. This is Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
The intense emotions and experiences of the holiday season are especially fertile ground for our Mind's Eye poets. Here are 3 very different views of the holidays from poets Jackie Wilson, Evie Thompson, and Lynn Patrick Smith.
The second week of January. Along the streets the snow is lost beneath exhaust and tossed out Christmas trees, and amid the freeze that January breathes into the new year, we are so holiday hungover, we don't notice that the days are getting longer, and there is always a time for starting over. This is Lynn Patrick Smith.
Emptiness and joy. Christmas, with all its emptiness, is upon us. We push back the black night with pagan-colored lights. Alcohol blocks out the fear. Shopping and crowd noise cover over the voice inside that says, "You are alone." We pay our dues to maintain friendships, looking for the right gift, the right card, the right phrase, deluding ourselves that this is love, believing that if we are loved, we can hold off death. Hurried, distressed, fearful of displeasing, we smile, invite, and respond to unwished-for gifts. "Oh, this is exactly what I've been wanting." And yet, as the dark comes down, I sit by my window. White snow, luminous blue sky, stars, red taillights on the distant road. In these, reassurance, God is with us. The Christmas babble gives way, and approaching like a cautious small wild animal is the illumination of this December time, that God sent his Son so I would know I am loved, and before me lies eternity. This is Evie Thompson.
A Solstice Story. Early one winter solstice night, a witch was riding up to the nearest star. As she crossed the moon, her broomstick brushed against it, leaving a trace of magic that grew, as magic does. As the moon rose higher, its sorcery-laced beams spread over the sky. Where the night was clear, the broad white rays blended depth with the darkness to form a translucent infinity of seawater with flecks of star salt and tall evergreen seaweed. Where the night was cloudy, sharpened needles of ray etched a delicate picture of cameo clouds on a shell sky. This celestial vision lasted until a dawn rinsed it away, hatching its own peacock magic into the world. This is Jackie Wilson for Mind's Eye Radio.
That was New Year's Waltz from Mind's Eye composer Paul Thompson.
Winter solstice is a celebration of the beginning of winter and the new solar year. We think it's important to keep alive the memory of winter solstice and its traditions so that as we grow in our own awareness of our connection with the greater cycles of nature, we also can see ourselves in relation with the traditional folk ways of our ancestors. Part of the reason you see so many decorations associated with not only religious Christmas, but secular Christmas, having these colors, red, green, and white, is because today's Christmas celebrations really are a continuation of the pagan winter solstice celebrations of the pre-Christian past. Santa Claus himself is actually a composite figure, weaving together folklore from different cultures and different faith traditions. So in addition to having some of his roots in the Christian saint, you know, Saint Nicholas, he also embodies some of the characteristics of Odin, the Norse god Odin, who would ride through the sky with an eight-leg horse, and some of the qualities of the Swedish Tomte, who were nature spirits that people sought to appease at this time of year. In fact, Santa's elves really are dressed very much like the depictions of the Scandinavian nature spirits, and the idea of leaving out cookies and milk for Santa really is a carryover of the old custom of leaving out offerings for the spirits of nature. And it was said that if you did this, your house would be blessed with prosperity in the coming calendar year. Some cultures in Europe had gift bringers who were female instead of male. In old Italy, Befana, the good witch Befana, would ride through the air on her broomstick and would bring toys and gifts to the children if they were good. In Germany, there's a goddess named Hulda who had a great cape made of goose down, and it was said that she too came to bring gifts at this time of year. And I hope that in the midst of all of our holiday hustle and bustle, as people engage in gift exchanging, they understand not only the spirit of giving and receiving, but realize how they are keeping alive a very ancient solstice tradition that's connected with renewal and strengthening bonds of connection with others. I really think that winter solstice is a holiday that people can celebrate regardless of what their religious tradition or nationality is. I think it's a wonderful folk holiday, and it can bring folks together to appreciate some of the more peaceful aspects of this time of year, as well as to look at the larger Christmas celebrations and the other holiday celebrations that occur in American society in the month of December in the perspective of how all of that ties in to our relationship with the web of life of nature.
That was Selena Fox from a 1995 interview. Selena Fox is founder of the Circle Sanctuary, located in Blue Mounds, Wisconsin. You can find them on the web at www.circlesanctuary.org.
Christmas Eve 1990 found Fred's kids with their mom on the other side of town.
Madison writer Ken Haynes.
They would come over to Fred's house sometime Christmas afternoon. He had modest gifts stashed in the basement that he had purchased before his checkbook went completely dry. But there was no tree and no money to buy one. Not only was a tree a symbol of peace, harmony, family, and renewal, it represented something very basic that fathers were required to provide for their kids. It was as essential as food. Fred checked through all the pockets of his clothes with the hope of turning up a forgotten 20, but no such luck, not even a quarter. Many of his pants pockets were still turned inside out from his last closet raid, and $20 wouldn't even come close to being enough to buy a tree anyway. The prospect of a treeless Christmas would have been unthinkable 1 year before, while Fred still held his cop job. He had reached the point where he couldn't stand it anymore. The turning point had come one cold winter evening as he was taking a bath in preparation for the night shift. The bathroom was hot and steamy, but Fred's soul felt as cold and hard as the kernels of sleet that pummeled the white aluminum siding of the house. He pulled the bathtub plug, then sat there long after the water had drained out, trying to muster up the strength to get out of the tub, dry himself, put on the blue synthetic uniform, the fake smile, real gun and bullets. It was that night that Fred realized that the night shift was not comprised of 8 hours, but of 28,000 seconds that squeezed 1 ounce of spirit out of him with each tick of his $15.99 drugstore watch. 10 years of hearing the pathetic stories of people's lives descended on the bathroom that night. He only had a vague memory of when he actually cared, and there was such a time. At least, he hoped so. The phone had rung off the wall with modeling jobs 2 weeks before and 2 weeks after Fred quit his wretched job as a cop. No high fashion gigs, no GQ covers, just solid commercial print jobs with a TV commercial thrown in every now and then. The checks were nice when they came, and the lights were intoxicating. When the modeling jobs were plentiful, Fred wondered why he had spent so many years chasing bad guys down alleys and locking up harmless people who were simply too poor to pay their fines. When his phone was silent for days and weeks at a time, he thought of chasing bad guys with fond affection, because he got paid every other Thursday, whether he caught them or not. 'Twas the night before Christmas and no tree in sight, not a wreath or poinsettia, not even a bough. Fred watched his A Wonderful Life 5 times in 2 days. He had not thought it humanly possible to hate Jimmy Stewart, but not only had he come to hate Jimmy, but Donna Reed was starting to get on his nerves. Her incessant optimism and hairdo that withstood man-made and natural disasters was too much to bear. Fred didn't hold out much hope that his neighbors would appear on his doorstep with bushels of money, and there was no angel to convince him that the world would be worse off without him. Perry Como's rendition of Ave Maria sounded anemic coming from the plastic boombox that would be the main present for one of his kids. Fred didn't know what he hated more, the raspy humming of the furnace or watching his breath when it was silent. His dog, Timothy, stretched out on his stomach with his chin resting on the edge of his empty bowl. His eyes rolled up lazily at Fred when he walked by, and he moved his tail about 6 inches to the left. Fred took the gesture as a wag. The kitchen table was heaped with noxious mail, ads and flyers with grinning people standing around fat Christmas trees with glistening bulbs and way too much tinsel. An envelope stamped important insurance information enclosed. A bill from the electric company, a bill from the phone company, two letters from the IRS that Fred was afraid to open, and four bank overdraft statements. Fred's 1974 Mercedes diesel sat in the gravel driveway next to the house. It had been a fine machine in its day, but now it looked tired and only started when it felt like it, and it rarely felt like it during the long Wisconsin winter. Fred thought that he had better plug in the engine heater if he planned to go anywhere, but shrugged his shoulders and shuffled back inside the house when he remembered that he didn't have anywhere to go. Fred slept like a hibernating bear that Christmas Eve. He had worn himself out worrying about how and where he was going to get a tree with no money. But he knew that he would, and that realization brought some peace. He awoke Christmas morning and turned the heat up all the way to 70. He let Timothy outside and filled his dog dish halfway with the last of the dog food, then filled his bowl with fresh water. After all, it was Christmas. The sun was still asleep behind lazy rows of houses. Fred stood in the tiny backyard and looked up at the sky. The stars looked majestic against their ink-blue backdrop, like a fine diamond necklace in a lush velvet case. He scanned the serene landscape, thinking what a glorious place Earth was before the people got up. The lone arborvitae at the southeast corner of the house caught his attention. It had grown from a bush to a tree over the years without Fred noticing. Then he had the bright and desperate revelation that the top several feet could pass for a Christmas tree. That's what he would do. He would climb to the top of the overgrown bush and cut off the top 5 or 6 feet. Then Fred was overtaken by a sudden wave of depression as he re-entered the painful awareness of his plight. Besides, he did not have a ladder tall enough, nor were the limbs of the arborvitae strong enough to hold his weight. He stormed into the house and grabbed his car keys. He kicked himself for not plugging in the engine heater in the aging Mercedes the night before. It was 16 years old now and resented being started without the benefit of nice warm oil. It obliged Fred anyway and started after just 5 tries. He drove through the deserted streets and enjoyed the freedom of it. He cranked up the radio loud and sang along with Mahalia Jackson singing Silent Night. Man, nobody could sing Silent Night like Mahalia. It felt good to be on the road, and there was only one thing in the world that he knew. He would not return home without a tree. He drove down the causeway and alongside the bay that glistened in the first rays of light. A police squad car sat in the parking lot by the park shelter. Its parking lights were on. Fred wondered if he knew the officer inside and thought of the many nights he had camped out in assorted parking lots while waiting the end of his shift. Fred continued to head east, determined to have a plan before he reached the outer limits of the city. He had to. The fuel gauge registered 1/8 of a tank. He was cruising along, feeling surprisingly peaceful, when he was attracted to gaudy lights and small triangular plastic flags flapping above a fleet of desperate-looking cars that would only be purchased by people who needed transportation as desperately as Fred needed a tree. The sign that hung over the entrance of the lot read, Repo Depot. Somebody's loss is your gain. Financing available, but not recommended. But behind the car lot, and to the right of the area enclosed in a chain-link fence that housed ceramic dogs, deer, and a moose with half a rack of antlers, was a corral made of snow fence, and inside were the Christmas trees that nobody wanted. Some were full in front with sparse foliage in back. Others were just ugly. But they all looked beautiful to Fred, and to take one, he reasoned, would not be stealing, because who bought Christmas trees on Christmas Day anyway? Surely they would be dumped or burned. Fred hopped over the fence and walked around examining the trees as if he were a legitimate shopper. He picked up an 8-footer and bounced it up and down. Only a few needles fell off. It was a good tree. Fred ceremoniously opened the trunk of his car, gently laid the tree inside, and started the drive home. The same squad car was parked in the same parking lot by the park shelter. Night had given way to day, and Fred could see inside the squad car now. He could tell that the officer was looking down and imagined that she was finishing reports from the night before. The cop looked up abruptly. Fred gasped and instinctively checked his speedometer. It read 20 miles per hour. The speed limit was 50 on that stretch of road. The red and blue lights of the squad car jumped on, accompanied by a little bleep of the siren, and lit up the early morning sky. Fred jammed on his brakes without thinking, coming to a dead stop in the middle of the road. He thought of the branches of the Christmas tree protruding from the open trunk of his car like the leg of a dead body hanging out, signaling the police officer to discover his crime. The cop leaned out of her car window and shouted, "You have a Merry Christmas!" Fred opened his mouth wide and tried to speak. No words came out. He put his car in motion and tried again to speak. "I will, Diane, and you have a Merry Christmas, too." This is Ken Haynes from Mind's Eye Radio.
My name is Lim. I come from Korea. We have a traditional holiday. It's kind of a Thanksgiving day. We say Chuseok. We always have a December, early December. We also cook traditional food like rice cook or some special fish or some special beef. American doesn't have it about our country food, so it's not usual in America, but just a greeting for our ancestor. Yeah, and thank for God giving a meal. Yeah, we have a happy holidays. 즐거운 명절 보내세요. Happy holidays.
Hi, my name is Yeonsil from Korea. Actually, we have another holiday called 설날, like New Year's Day. 설날 is the biggest holiday, I think. We wear traditional clothes called 한복. Actually, that is January 1st, but lunar month, not solar month. January or February, that will be changed. Food, we prepare bulgogi or rice cake soup, and many kinds of food because we have to celebrate for ancestors and bow together.
까치까치 설날은 어저께고요 우리 설날은 오늘이에요. Yeah, that's all.
We have like happy holiday and it called 새해 복 많이 받으세요. It means it will be good luck to you in this year.
Hi, my name is Wen Wen. I come from Taiwan. And I think around this time, Chinese New Year is coming very soon. February, I think, because we have Chinese calendar, it's different. So around this time, before Chinese New Year Eve, every family have to clean their house, very clean. And in Chinese New Year, all the family members have to get together. It's very important to get together in Chinese Year Eve. And then we will eat a lot of food, probably over 10 different kind of food, like fish. And we cannot finish the fish. That means we can have good luck. So never finish the fish. And then fry rice cake. That's sweet. And many, many different kind of food. We celebrate the whole week. But the Chinese New Eve and the Chinese New Year, the first day is the most important day. The second day is like the daughter who married to other people, they have to go back. Like if I marry someone, mm-hmm. and on the second day of Chinese New Year, I have to go back to my own family. I didn't stay in my husband's family. Just one day. Uh-huh. Oh, everybody have to wear new clothes, new shirts, new pants, new underwear. Everything have to be new. And traditional family that prefer red, so everything red is good, no black. Red in Chinese is lucky, very good luck. You can see a red family in Chinese New Year. In the department store, everything is red. Yeah.
恭喜发财. My name is Claire. I'm from Taiwan. The Chinese New Year's, before the Chinese New Year's, the whole family will gather and to eat the feast. After the dinner, parents will give the child the money. The money is put in the red envelope, only for the child that didn't get married. And if you bring your younger child to another people's friend's house, and your friends have to give the money to your child. Yeah, always put in the red envelope. Because we celebrate the Chinese New Year's about 15 days. And we have to eat like we call the Tang Yuan. It's kind of a red bean.
Rice
bean.
It's a ball.
Yeah, it's a ball. Maybe have the white or red, the color. And it's sweet. You eat the Tang Yuan and you add your age 1 year.
路过大街小巷，每个人的嘴里见面第一句话就是恭喜恭喜恭喜恭喜恭喜恭喜你呀，恭喜恭喜恭喜你。
Okay.
The 恭喜 is congratulation because the traditional story. If you can next day you saw another people, oh congratulation, you are alive.
Thanks to Yoon Suk Lim and Yoon Chil Kim, both from Korea, and Wenwen Liu and Claire Wan from Taiwan. They're students at the Wisconsin English as a Second Language Institute. You're listening to Holidays Without the Hype on Mind's Eye Radio. The holiest of holidays are those kept by ourselves in silence and apart, the secret anniversaries of the year. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
The name of this book is Welcome Back, Sun, by Michael Emberley. The sun never rose today. When I came home from school, it was dark. When I left for school, it was dark. It has been this way for months. I live in a small village in Norway, wedged deep in a narrow mountain valley. The sun left our village and went behind the mountains in September. It hasn't come back. Now it is almost March. Outside, the air is cold and still. The winter night has crawled over us. Nature has fallen asleep. It is this way every year. In Norway, we call this season the Mørketiden, the murky time. At the beginning of winter, when the sun first disappears, I don't miss it so much. With all the holidays and everyone so busy, I just don't think about it. But after the last Christmas candle is put away, I start to feel the hunger, as if I hadn't eaten for months. By March, I am really hungry for sunshine. Papa doesn't seem to feel this hunger, but I know Mama does. It makes her fret and stare and snap at me. I hate the Mørketiden. Mama once told me a story of when the sun got lost for the first time, many years ago. After months of darkness in our village, one small girl could not bear it any longer, so she slipped away to search for the sun. She climbed for days high into the mountains, the frigid blackness around her screened with angry Arctic squalls. She struggled through waist-deep snow. She slipped over ice-glazed rocks. On the fourth day, toes nearly frozen, she finally saw a familiar yellow glow coming from behind a tall black crag. She was on the far side of Mount Gausta, the largest of the mountains that wall in our valley, and she had found the lost sun. With the sun melting a clear path through the snow, the little girl led the way back through the mountains and down to the valley, where the whole village was waiting with hugs, cheers, and warm things to eat. People today still make the little girl's trek up Mount Gausta to glimpse the sun after a long dark winter and to show it the way home. "Could we climb the Gausta, Papa?" I asked one cold, dark morning, like the girl in the story. "It will be time soon," says Papa, "time for the sun to come back." He gives me a tired smile. Papa works inside all day. He leaves early in the morning and comes home late. He never sees any sunlight during winter. He says that sometimes it's hard for him, even to remember what the sunshine looks like. A week has passed, and the sky brightens now at noontime. Mama and I go out to the short daylight to gather budded branches. We will bring the cuttings inside and place them by a window in water. "The buds will open there before they do outside," Mama says. "They will tell us when spring has come." When we are ready to go home, the brightness is already fading. Quickly, we slip back over the snow to the village, racing the dark. Before I close the door behind me, I pause and watch the last pale light leave, slowly giving the sky back to black. The paper said that the sun rose in the south today. In the city of Oslo, the streets were full of dancing people wearing sunny costumes and playing sunny music. It was a holiday. But here in our village, the sun is still hiding. Each day I watch the sky. Each day I examine the branches, fingering each closed bud. But the Mørketiden goes on. "Couldn't we climb the Gausta?" I ask Mama, like the girl in the story. "We will wait," says Mama. "The sun will be back soon." It is now long past the time when the sun came back last year. "It should be any day now," Papa says. But bad weather has come into our valley. Thick gray clouds block out all the light in the sky, even the brightness. For the first time, I see the strain of the murky time in Papa's eyes. He was stronger than us, but now he, too, craves the sun's warm yellow rays on his face. He, too, hungers for the color and life that sun gives everything it touches. I climb into Papa's lap. "Couldn't we climb the Gausta?" I ask softly. Papa looks at Mama. I know at once we will go, together. It has been a long, dark winter for all of us. That night, Papa, Mama, and I pack food for the trip. Cheese and flatbread, smoked salmon, and some water. From my bedroom window, I see stars. The clouds have slipped away. Tomorrow will be clear. We get up early. Outside it is cold, but I cannot feel it. A thick crust is on the snow. I walk on top of it, but Papa falls through. Dark shapes crunch up the trail ahead of us. Some carry skis. They need to see the sun, too. They also cannot wait. The trail, pocked with craters from other climbers' boots, is hard work for everyone. Some will be going all the way to the top of Mount Gausta. But we will only go as far as the pass. It will be high enough. As we stop to rest, others pass in the half-light, puffing out white clouds. No one climbs past without a smile and a wave. Few will get much work done today. Bosses and teachers will understand. Any Norwegian would. Now we're hiking faster. The closer we get, the brighter the sky becomes on the crest of the pass. Mama squeezes my hand, hot and sweaty, inside my rough wool mitten. My legs hurt. I am breathing hard, but I am not complaining. "Almost there," whispers Mama. My heart is thumping. Suddenly, the sky explodes with brilliant light. I shield my eyes and squint. The brilliance flashes off snow and ice. It glitters and sparkles off rocks and trees. At last we have reached the pass, and the sun. Hundreds of people pepper the White Ridge, gazing at the splendor of simple sunshine, refreshing memories and warming spirits. Scattered happy shouts echo on the mountain. Some of us dance. I can't stop smiling. We eat our salmon sitting on a black rock warm by the sun. I close my eyes and face the dimming glow, chewing and smiling, smiling and chewing. Soon we have to leave. It is already getting colder. As we pack our things, I start yawning. Papa lifts me to his warm, woolly back. I shut my eyes. I don't remember the trip home. I wake up later in my bed, then thunder downstairs. The sun followed us, Mama says. It peeked into the valley and touched the house while you were sleeping. We go to the window so I can see the sun on the snow. Then I notice the branches. There, on a gnarled twig, the first buds have opened, the first tiny splash of color on an old gray canvas. Spring has finally come. Welcome back, son. This is Guy Thorvaldsen reading Welcome Back, Son by Michael Emberley, published by Little Brown and Company.
The year, 564 A.D. Dagobert and Cuthbert sit on a big log outside the communal hut. Warriors of a band of Goths that roam Central Europe, they take turns poking a stick at a small pile of ashes at their feet.
Sure is dark, Cuthbert.
They don't call it the Black Forest for nothing.
Romans could sneak up without our even knowing it.
Romans are pisspots, Dagobert. They're more afraid of the dark than a girl's are.
Sure wish electricity was invented.
If wishes were horses, beggars would ride.
Wolves are getting closer.
Had to run them off with a firebrand last night.
Seems every 12 months, the sun god spends most of his time beneath the earth. A Goth can hardly see a hand before his eyes.
I'd go home, but my wife would put me to work skinning rabbits for the kids' coats. Awful bloody work, that.
Skinning is what Goths do. Vandals and Huns, too.
Yeah. Sometimes I think I'm a man born before his time. Sure is cold.
Fine time to get cold, just when the sun god leaves the sky.
Ever notice? Sun god moves south every year just as the ice and snow move in. Comes up low in the sky over by the bone pile there. Where do you suppose he goes?
I'd say Lido Beach. Heard they go topless down there.
Sounds like a nice place to pillage and burn once the light comes back. Haven't laid a waste to a town for months.
Makes me feel lower than fish droppings. Wish we had a little light out here. Heat, too.
We got any more lager in the holding pit?
Drank the last of it 30 suns past.
Say, Dagobert, see that big balsam tree over there?
Yeah.
I got an idea. We get some candles from the lodge. Bring them out here. Set them up in the branches of that tree. Then we roll this log up close, and we'll have light. Maybe even some heat.
By Woden, I believe you've got something there. Let's do it.
Okay, be careful there, Dagobert. Put it there, up good and high. Yeah.
That was a nifty idea, Cuthbert. Look at how she sparkles.
12 candles, and it's brighter than a Roman general's nose at midday.
Look, here comes Alaric, and Ceres, and the women. They've noticed our amazing invention.
Uh-oh. Dagobert, look. The tree. The needles are burning.
We're the center of attention. What a great invention, Cuthbert.
But look now. The top of the balsam is on fire.
What light it gives off, and warmth. Come on, let's move closer.
Whoa, partner. Youch! Hot ash down my back.
Run for your life.
Ouch!
It's going up like Mendicant's funeral pyre.
Whew! That was some show, Dagobert.
You see how everybody scattered when the firebrand started falling on them?
But warm. I'm still toasty as if we'd sacked Florence.
Yeah. Say, Cuthbert.
You thinking what I'm thinking?
We got any more of those balsam trees around the hut, partner?
Plenty. We could have a candle fire every night.
What should we call our invention?
Well, this time of year, those crazy Christians light candles to what they call Christmas. How about How about calling our invention a Christmas tree?
Yeah, yeah.
And that, you Goths and Vandals, is how Dagobert and Cuthbert invented the first Christmas tree.
The 2000 holiday season started at a time when the 2000 election season was still underway. The combination inspired commentator Norma Gay Pruitt to envision what one of the candidates might have on his wish list.
Little Geordie and the Great Big Package. Little Geordie Shrub could hardly wait for morning to peek over the rugged, gigantic cactus which served as the family's Christmas tree thing. He just knew that nestled among the bottles of alcohol-free wild turkey, called tame turkey, and the candy cocaine Pez dispenser would be the thing he wanted most of all. He sat bolt upright as he heard the jingle of sleigh bells receding down the long, curving driveway where he and little Laura, his best gal, had ridden their stick horses many a long day. Sometimes they would visit the old post office slash general store slash feed store slash voting precinct slash gas station to see if they could find Geordie's daddy, Big George, with his foot hiked up on a nail keg, telling stories about the old days when Big George and Danny Quayle would lick 10 Democrats afore they ever had their breakfast tacos. Little Geordie always sat wrapped and stiff as a poker until Dickie the Chainy reached over and wiped his lower lip and shut his pie hole for him. Sometimes Big Mama Whitehair would have to come and haul Big George off by his ear if they got to talking too rough on account of she knew that Little Geordie was impressionable and she wanted him to make something of himself and stay out of filthy politics. She'd leave that to his smarter brother Jeb, the one that wasn't in the pokey over the consarn savings and loan thing. This morning, though, Little Georgie was sartin he could find his heart's content under that bushy cactus. He snuck quietly down the stairs and began to rip just a corner from the first brightly wrapped package. Feeling guilty, he shook it just a little first, thinking to find out what could be in it without actually opening it. Several little square tabs filtered out and dotted Little Georgie's Roy Rogers pajamas. "Nothing but Chad's," he muttered, tossing the box aside. It was impossible to know who they were for. The box wasn't marked, and Geordie knew both his dad and brother had piles of such boxes laying around the ranch just in case. Geordie opened packages containing all manner of guns and weapons. Some were marked for concealed use only, and to be used on mourning doves alone. One friend of his dad's sent him the keys to a new tank, which sat gleaming under camouflage outside on the jet tarmac. That's what the Pentagon always sent. It didn't impress him. After all, they wouldn't let him drive it after that DUI incident when he had been a young and callow 30-year-old. What fun was it to own a tank if you couldn't start a war all by yourself? His interest was piqued momentarily when he spied a really large box with a cord coming out the back. "Could it be?" he whispered breathlessly. "Do they make 'em that run by electricity in Texas?" He tore the paper off frantically, but then sat back in a dejected lump, his cowboy hat tilting forlornly over his eyes. The shiny new electric chair buzzed hopefully, but Geordie just kicked at it with his boots. He knew he had to pretend for his folks that these were the best presents a boy could want, or they might send him back into the Texas Air Guard. The other boys had hated him there and kept pouring molasses into his jet's gas tank and pulling other mean tricks. He moped around the house as one after the other of the Shrub family awoke and opened their presents, a new state for Jeb, since Florida had turned out to be such a disappointment, a Catherine Harris doll for Daddy. She always smiled and did things just as Daddy said. Babs hadn't asked for anything that year except a big stuffed red elephant. Seemed everything they got, a new redrawn map with some troublesome states taken right out, was bright red, the color of Geordie's face when he'd had too much loco weed. Geordie fried a few little green plastic army men and a mouse or two in his new electric chair, but Babs and Big could tell his heart really wasn't in it. They waited, smiling slyly, until all the presents had been opened and all the paper carefully pressed for reuse. You never could tell what the family coffers would be like in the following years. Then Big George slipped on his chaps and swaggered out to the stable. "Come here, young'un," he said to little Geordie. His hand grazed the row of Band-Aids that little Geordie had slapped on for good luck, a kind of private magic he hoped would bring him what he wanted most of all. There, beside the lariats and saddles, was the oddest-looking, most misshapen package Geordie had ever seen. It wiggled and squirmed. Strange and exotic odors of donuts and coffee wafted from the top. Little Geordie could not contain himself any longer. He ripped open the top to find 26 faithful electors. He didn't even ask how his dad and Jeb had been forced to change the old constitution to find the 26th elector. He didn't want to know. Squeezing his legs tight together, he began to mouth the words, "I solemnly swear to uphold the Republican Constitution as it has been revised by the Florida legislature as the law of this land." This is Norma Gay Pruitt giving thanks to Molly Ivins for her inspiration for Mind's Eye Radio.
You've been listening to Holidays Without the Hype, written by members of the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Sue Renard. Contributing writers include Esther Cameron, Ken Haynes, Norma Gay Pruitt, Dick Radke, Sue Renard, Lynn Patrick Smith, Elena Tabachnik, Paul Thompson, Evie Thompson, Kelly Warren, Jackie Wilson, and Fran Zell. If you'd like a copy of this show or would like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, call 608-256-6525 or visit our website at www.mindseyeaudio.com. I'm Greg Willard. Ring out the old, ring in the new. Ring, happy bells across the snow. The year is going, let him go. Ring out the false, ring in the true. Alfred Lord Tennyson.